Welcome to Bible Study, Parody and Subversion in Matthew's Gospel. Back in December, I did an interview with Dr. Sebastian Doan of the University of Laval in Quebec City. It was a great success. He was a wonderful guest, and I've received a lot of good feedback from that interview, with some listeners saying they want more of that sort of thing. So today, we have another amazing guest, a scholar who is doing what I think is some groundbreaking work. Dr. James Fair, also from Canada, but living in Germany, is working on translation issues and perhaps producing translations of selected New Testament texts. He's a listener of this podcast, and although I don't do that much with translation myself, that's not my strong suit, his work has some surprising parallels to what I've been doing and will, I think, be of great interest to the listeners of this podcast. So without any further delay, let's get right into this. Welcome, James.
Thanks, Bert. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
Can you tell us something about yourself? You had an interesting upbringing in addition to your education and professional experience, which had an impact on the work, the translation work you're doing. Can you start by telling us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. My personal biography is connected in several ways to this translation project. My parents and grandparents were Low German-speaking Mennonites from Mexico. Going to school in Canada, I remember one of my earliest experiences was being treated as an outsider, actually jeered at as a strange foreigner. But I assimilated quickly, and in any case, I look like your typical white Canadian. Later, I studied theology, classical studies, philosophy, political history. I found Marxist thought interesting, partly because of its connection to my family's background as impoverished day laborers. I went on to finish my doctoral studies in Germany, where once again I began as an outsider, but became very quickly assimilated. My dissertation focused on the tensions between abstract philosophy and the concrete message of Jesus in the controversy between pietism and rationalism, on the attempts to translate the Jesus story in a way that would make it relevant to Prussia in the 18th century. After that, after lecturing for a while, I became a Mennonite pastor for a little more than 4 years. But for the last 13 years now, I've been the director of the Mennonite Peace Committee here in Germany. One of our most important projects is supporting the human rights of refugees and migrants on the Greek island of Lesbos in conjunction with Christian peacemaker teams. But I also write on biblical and Anabaptist theology whenever I can.
Wow, excellent. So like for me and many of the listeners of this podcast, the message of the Bible is not merely an academic interest for you. You are putting it into practice. It speaks to your history, which in turn enhances your academic work. There are some who say that you can't really understand the gospel unless you're practicing it. Now, your New Testament translation work has parallels with what I've been doing in this podcast. You also see Jesus as a politically aware actor who is critical of the existing hierarchies of power and who is calling for a new society of justice for all. Can you give us an example of the kind of translation work that you're doing?
There's a good example in a well-known passage in the letter to the Philippians. In the translation of the NIV, Paul writes as follows: "Our citizenship is in heaven, and we eagerly await a savior from there, the Lord Jesus Christ." It's in chapter 3. Now, we can ask lots of critical questions about this translation. For example, why is the word citizenship used? The modern connotation of this word is that of an individual with a specific passport living in a modern country with very clear and strongly guarded borders. I carry a Canadian passport, and that means that I cannot vote while I'm living here in Germany, as I'm not recognized as a citizen. Using a biblical concept, you could say I'm a little bit like a sojourner. And it might be expected that at some point in time I will return to Canada. But this phrase, our citizenship is in heaven, that suggests in a similar way that Christian citizens will return to heaven because they don't really belong here. Mm-hmm. Whereas our status here is actually more like dual citizenship, perhaps. But of course, these two citizenships actually are incompatible with one another. We need to acknowledge as well that there were no solid borders in antiquity. So the primary division was not between citizens and non-citizens. People were divided into categories on an entirely different basis. In the empire, you were a Roman citizen, or a freed person, or a slave, or alternately you were a member of some ethnic group. Also problematic are the words eagerly awaiting a savior. That sounds almost like we're in serious difficulty here and we're just pining for someone to come and rescue us. The implication is that we want someone to take us away from this place. I find both of these ideas problematic because they don't really provide a good picture of what Jesus has portrayed in the Gospels, or Paul, for that matter, really thought. These people weren't helpless, they weren't passive, they didn't want to get away from here. And by the way, I don't want to leave Germany either. Finally, I would add the translation savior fails to articulate the political connotation of the Greek word sotia. So I translate this passage quite differently. Our government has alternative headquarters, and it is from there that we are expecting the appointed head of state, our sovereign, Jesus, to arrive. With this reading, the entire feeling of the passage is suddenly different. It's not like we're in need of rescuing from some terrible place, but rather, we know that the politics of our country is messed up, and we need the real head of state to arrive and be with us and alongside us and through us to fix things. A further thought is that the word translated as citizenship, politeuma, actually signifies a strategy of governing and administering. It could even suggest something like a political ideology. To say that our organizing idea or our political principle is in the heavens isn't a far stretch from what Matthew calls the kingdom of the heavens. Mm-hmm. And you've described that really well. It's definitely not pie in the sky stuff. Sure, it's true in a certain sense we are living in exile, but we want to make this place, this world, this right. country a safe home for everyone. We want to bring this alternative right. government to power under the leadership and inspiration of our head of state.
Exactly, right. The way the text has been translated with religious language, language that doesn't really get used anywhere but in church or religious conversations, gives the impression that the Gospels are talking about something removed from this world and everyday life in this world. Whereas Jesus and his movement in Matthew are very much concerned about and invested in this world and are trying to bring heaven down to earth, which is why the model prayer includes God's will be done, or your will be done, your kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. Now, I love that you're doing this work, but some people might ask, why are you pursuing this translation project? Don't we have enough new translations? There are so many new translations out on the market, Messianic Bibles, Internet Bibles, Simplified Bibles, Children's Bibles, new KJV, new NIV. And then there's new paraphrases like The Message and so on. Where does it end?
You're right, Bert. Actually, I find, first of all, that a multiplicity of voices and a diversity of perspective is a good thing. And I'm working in a field where thousands of scholars are toiling with the scriptures, scrutinizing the jots and tittles, so to speak. If there's one thing that's missing, though, in most of these translations, it is a liberationist and activist perspective in translating the New Testament. So I have focused on key passages as signposts for a new political reading. It begins with questioning those translations that come from a dominant, powerful, hierarchical Christianity. These highly privileged translations, influenced by power and established elites, are not really in tune with the gist of this literature. Our standard translations reflect that, beginning with the Vulgata, the first officially recognized Latin translation. Up until very recently, most translations have in fact been approved by the powers that be. There are a few exceptions, like the Tyndale Bible. And as we know, those powers have interests to protect. They want the translation that they have approved to be in alignment with their vested interests and traditions. The New Testament and the Hebrew Bible very clearly originate from and spoke the language of a disadvantaged minority. These writings came from a subsection of society that suffered from hostility and racism, and yet they didn't stay quiet. They spoke and wrote about their disadvantages, and in spite of attempts to silence them, these writings condemned injustice. The texts reflect the stories and thought processes of activists working to transform social, religious, and political life. Your podcast, Bert, Parody and Subversion in Matthew's Gospel, provides important exegesis of this protest literature, which is almost conspiratorial. My own focus is on the translation itself. I look at specific semantic domains like freedom, faith, love, truth, and so on. And I want to see these central concepts transformed from the same perspective that you take when you interpret the Gospel of Matthew. Unfortunately, very few people are asking the question, how would we translate the key terminology of the New Testament differently if we believe that the authors were part of a movement for social and political change inspired by Torah and Jesus? Would we still use the words faith, love, freedom? And I think that these terms can be retired because there are better options.
Wait. No to faith, love, or freedom?
Well, before getting to those concepts, and we can get to them, let's think more fundamentally about what we're doing when we translate. How can we understand strange sentences in a foreign tongue? Perhaps you've seen the movie Arrival. This huge spaceship comes down to Earth and hovers above it, sending out these utterly unintelligible messages. And there's this linguist who tries to decipher the messages coming from the extraterrestrials, beings with no connection to anything on Earth. How does she even begin to translate strange texts from a society or a group of people with absolutely no connection to ours? Well, she needs some sort of a starting point to achieve understanding. Now, we don't have it quite as hard. Jesus was invited to meals. He walked dirt roads. He talked about planting fields, waiting for harvests, things that seem to us intuitively understandable. So there are features of the New Testament that makes these texts sound very familiar. And this encourages us then to take these foreign texts from a foreign culture and make them sound like something like us. We are the target in the translation process, and the emphasis is on hitting the target. So, where we have a biblical passage that is somewhat more obscure, for example, where it says something like, it touches my innards, or it touches our innards. Well, we translate that as moving our spirits, because that's the way we would say it. It sounds much more familiar to us. But this simple explanation for a difficult passage underestimates the seriousness of the translation problem in general. First century Greek is the expression of a life world entirely different from ours. I would ask your listeners, why should the sentences that Paul or Matthew or Mark wrote 2,000 years ago sound familiar to us? Shouldn't their words actually strike us as singularly odd, peculiar, or at times even bizarre? Think about Shakespeare writing English a mere 400 years ago. I don't know who among us can actually just read Shakespeare without a dictionary at hand, or at least footnotes. In his play Henry IV, he had this curse that I've just looked up. "Oh, for the breath to utter what is like thee, you tailor's yard, you sheath, you bowcase, you vile standing tuck." I found that passage using an online Shakespeare insulter. And I don't think you'll have to bleep those words for your program.
I think we're fine.
I think so. Yeah. What we have here, though, is not only just unusual turns of phrase, but rather we run up against the wall that separates us from the lived experience of the world of old Bill Shakespeare. Hmm. What is a tailor's yard? Or a standing tuck?
Yeah.
And yet the New Testament is so much farther away in time and social life. I think you do this really well in your podcast when you talk about purity codes or the honor-shame code. It's really hard for us to reimagine those social settings. We need to see that this is an a priori difficulty in target translation. Mm-hmm. There's lots of things that are recorded in the New Testament that have meaning in their context, but we have little understanding of what they really meant back then.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or only an inkling. So, you know, there are prosaic examples from the life world of ancient Palestine. What did it mean back then to kneel down or to prostrate mm-hmm. yourself? Mm-hmm. What exactly did it signify? And did it mean the same thing, irrespective of who is kneeling in front of whom?
Right.
What did it mean for people to touch their fingers to their lips every time they went past a sacred statue mm-hmm. or votive hearth? How did people of different social status view slaves mm. who were everywhere on the streets and in homes? Mm. Right. Now, we know some of these things, and we treat them as exotic differences. However, we need to understand them as politically relevant customs that have direct implications mm-hmm. for translating the New Testament. Mm-hmm. When a dispute arose between the Greek and Hebrew-speaking followers of Jesus in Acts chapter 6, we need to translate the passage with attention to the role of women in their culture. With a target translation, it simply looks like the Greek-speaking widows were complaining that they were being ignored. But there's more going on there than that. Hmm. Most men would hardly ever see women going about their lives because of the patriarchal separation of women's lives, since, after all, women were men's property.
Yes. Those are really good points. The cultural translation gets very short shrift, even among scholars, and definitely in our translations. And it's hard for us to imagine this culture at a different time and place, especially those of us who live in the West. Okay, so so-called target translations try to make foreign things sound too familiar. I think I have a sense of where you're going. But what exactly is the alternative? How do you get a translation that is modern, but also really counts as a genuine translation?
The other option is source translation, which doesn't domesticate the original text. The idea here is that the words should sound a little bit strange. Maybe the sentences should be difficult for us to understand. The message should sound jarring. And that's what I want to encourage us to accept. I want us to feel a little bit uneasy, a little bit thrown off by this message. After all, wasn't it the case back then that some people objected to the message of Jesus? Ideally, our translation should make us feel both curiously drawn to him, but also confused or troubled by Jesus' message.
Right. So the translation shouldn't translate too much. Should it leave us wondering what is being said so that it's going to stay wild and untamed because it shouldn't be controlled?
Yeah, that might happen, but that's not actually the reason for such translation. I'm not just trying to give people a headache when they're reading these texts or make it sound sensationally odd. Source translation isn't supposed to be hard for its own sake. Rather, there are, in this case, deeper, politically relevant motivations. First off, most people within so-called Christian societies think that the Bible is compatible with their lifestyles. The translations we use incline us to assume familiarity, as when people call God Father or Dad or even Daddy. But we need to be aware that a father in ancient patriarchal society had in principle absolute control over everyone in the household. We want to interpret this word father in a way that conforms to our culture. So we think that the word father primarily suggests something like emotional connection and intimacy. Now, in Jesus' day, it may have been true that people were emotionally attached to their father. They may have had a really good or really intimate relationship to their father, but that was incidental. That was secondary. Far more important was the fact that the father was the protector and provider of the household. He was the determinant of your social status. And not least of all, he had you personally at his complete disposal. He would determine what work you do, whom you would marry. That's what a father was understood to be.
Right.
So you can see how seductive it can be to use certain words. Words like citizenship and father are so familiar to us, we think the Bible is speaking directly to us, in a way sort of like advertising. And so why not continue in this spirit of advertising the comfortable news of the gospel? Let's market our translation for different tastes and identities. Why don't we give everyone the option to choose their own flavor? That way we can appeal to everyone. Over here in my office, I even have a little New Testament in camouflage design for soldiers to carry into battle. Sadly, we have co-opted the Bible for our capitalist societies and political agendas.
Wow, a camo Bible. Unless that's purposefully ironic, there is a way that camo could be revolutionary, but I don't think that's what the creators of that edition had in mind. Yeah, you're bringing up a lot of good points, some of which I've thought about getting into in the podcast a little bit more. You really did a good explanation there of the father, and I haven't gone that as far with it. So I really thank you for that. So that's why I try to look carefully at the social and political context of the stories in Matthew. If we look at the story of Jesus from the perspective of the historical context of domination by the Roman Empire and the specific political situation in Palestine, then, for example, the word sea used for Lake Gennesaret takes on a new meaning. It's drawing on the Hebrew tradition of seeing foreign oppressors as those who have crossed over the sea. If we translate the phrase kingdom of heaven as God's new society, it makes sense to see how this peasant scribe confronts the authorities and allies himself with the dispossessed peasantry and the outcasts of society.
Yes. And like I said, my work is taking your approach into the field of semantics. Traditional Bible interpretations over the centuries have tolerated or even encouraged political violence, racism, the oppression of women, biases against people of alternative sexuality. And I don't know, maybe just as bad or worse, these traditions have taught people that if they live a mainstream lifestyle and don't cause trouble, then they're doing the will of God. And these views are now being contested by demonstrating how they are rooted in political ideologies that favor the powerful, and by showing that an entirely different reading is not just possible, but actually stands in the Hebrew tradition. And now we need to move that work over into the field of Bible translation as well. Our translations are embedded in political ideologies. Whether consciously or not, we translate the Bible from a socio-political perspective. We're caught up in the messiness of our own social struggles, even when we're attempting to do the pure, abstract task of biblical translation, But there is no pure, abstract point of view from which we can render a translation in such a way that it offers a strict coherence to the source document. And since those scriptures are protest literature, its words are also expressing this, sometimes very obviously, sometimes only in a coded and veiled fashion. They may be intended as provocations, but they are first and foremost a call to live an alternative lifestyle, to swim against the mainstream, to not be conformed. And of course, that means they don't just appeal to everybody. These words are looking for hearers who are willing to think outside the box. But how can the message of Jesus provoke a transformative response if we think we already know what it's about? How can we regard his words as daring or risky if the biblical words flow so sweetly from our lips? Things like, let's just love everyone like Jesus did, or let's just have faith. A second point I'd like to make. Another reason for a translation that upsets our thinking is simply to motivate us to participate in new dialogues with strangers, to talk to them about the Bible in a different way. We generally don't move towards people with other beliefs and understandings. We think, that's not what we believe. We are different. So we hide behind our wall of standardized religious terminology, clearly defined borders. And the classic example, of course, is, are you saved? But another example that I would like to draw attention to is the word charis, which is traditionally translated as grace, whereas the normal meaning of the word in Jesus' time was simply generosity. I want us to wrestle with a phrase like liberated by God's generosity instead of saved by God's grace. Liberated by God's generosity. Using grace, whether we notice or not, erects a border between Christians and others because it's a code word for Christians. So I guess I'm calling for us to remove those kinds of borders. Jesus suggested that we move ourselves into unguarded places. He showed us how it's done. He encouraged others to move themselves from places of familiarity into spheres of thinking and engagement that are unsettled. That could well lead us into places of doubt and uncertainty, but that's okay. I think we're going to find God there. Or we could perhaps say it differently. Let's be courageous enough to live in the interplay between trust and mistrust. Now, at the same time, I want to admit that saying something like that can lead to tension, maybe even anxiety, because we definitely also need familiarity. We need a safe space. Yeah, we have our community. Our community is a bounded area. It's sort of fenced in, where we feel at home. It's important that we gather people into community. That's really constitutive for our life. We need to understand each other and have common words. But the problem is that boundaries limit the possibilities of relationship with the other. If we have a standard vocabulary, outsiders won't necessarily understand it. And we will have difficulty connecting to them. So that's a second significant reason for a source translation. It suggests to us that we can hear the call of Jesus to engage in dialogue with what is foreign, heterodox, uncontrollable, and with people who understand the divine completely differently. It's not about erasing borders entirely, but rather simply acknowledging them, reflecting on them, deciding where we should live with them and where we need to oppose them. The early Jesus movement confronted these kinds of misunderstandings at every turn. And when they got to the point of writing them down, They had to think about how to use normal Kini or Koine words for something entirely new. My concern is that our standard procedure for producing modern day translations makes it difficult for us to see how the writers of the New Testament were directly wrestling with, were engaged in communicating with completely foreign modes of thinking and behaving. Would it be all right, Bert, if I mentioned a third reason?
Sure, go right ahead.
Okay, I think some of your hearers may be familiar with the phrase the Constantinian shift, usually associated with the Emperor Constantine, so the very first Roman emperor to embrace Christian beliefs after a time of persecution or a long period of persecution. Under Constantinianism, Christianity went from being just one of many possible lifestyles to being the true, politically recognized religion. Now, in fact, the Constantinian shift didn't happen all at once. It was a long process that transformed the early Jesus movement into the established church. It began long before Constantine, and it actually took hundreds of years to achieve what we now call Christendom, an official church that was co-opted by the political leadership and was politically protected. As a consequence, Christianity became a cultic justification for the exercise of power and a tool in the expansion and maintenance of empire. Only after this adoption by the state was it possible to punish heresy in courts. And so that meant, of course, that the secular state could play a role in what you were allowed to believe. And the second result was that Christians no longer had any qualms about joining the military and killing enemies, in spite of what Jesus said, because non-believers were godless heathens. And there's a third result that eventually came about, that citizenship in the empire automatically made you a Christian, and the other way around. Now, what I'm saying there has all been discussed before. But one thing that I think has been neglected and needs to be properly investigated is how the Constantinian shift affected the vocabulary of theology and the translation of scripture. Now I'm getting to the heart of the issue. What happens when we translate the Bible from the perspective of Christendom? Well, it's pretty clear. No translation, no sermon can be critical of the state. After all, it's supposed to protect that particular political organization. So what does that mean? If we take everything together, sum it up, here we have all these texts by a liberation movement written from a highly disparaging standpoint, sharply denouncing state domination, criticizing politics and economics, and now suddenly these texts are being treated as holy and perfect and timeless. They're interpreted and translated as documents that supposedly uphold conventional society and the political state. Your podcast, Bird, is a good example of how people, I think, are waking up to the fact that we have been co-opted by the state. We have been depoliticized because we think that our faith has nothing to do with politics. But it surely has got a lot to do with it because of this peasant scribe who defied the authorities. I think it would help the church if it recognized how its basic vocabulary has been defanged, disempowered, rendered politically inconsequential.
So what you're demonstrating is, and what you're talking about is how translation itself is a political act. Now, my podcast focuses on the Gospel of Matthew. Do you have any reflections on the language of this so-called first gospel? Are there any special expressions or wordings of the Gospel of Matthew that we could think about when translating it?
Well, you've talked about the kingdom of heaven, and you have this alternative version of it. I think one of the most remarkable characteristics of Matthew compared with the other synoptic gospels is that the author decided against using the phrase Vasileia tou Theou, which is conventionally translated Kingdom of God, and instead opted for Vasileia ton Ouranon, that is, Kingdom of the Heavens. It's interesting that Luke's gospel here follows Mark, but Matthew doesn't. Why not? Matthew still sometimes uses the word God, Theos, in his text, but when referring to Jesus' vision for a new society, he chose a special phrase, Kingdom of the Heavens. Now, of course, we all understand pretty clearly that these two phrases are referring pretty much to the same thing. It's two different labels for basically the same agenda. It's like two completely identical jars of peanut butter. This one's more peanuts and the other one is less sugar. Kingdom of Heaven, Kingdom of God. But yeah, what's going on with Matthew then? I agree with you. The kingdom is not a place outside this world where our souls live after death. It's a political sphere on earth where the heavens do not rule but ought to rule, where God's instructions for justice and truth should hold sway. And you translate this phrase as the new society. I like that. There's an excellent German language translation that refers to it as God's world or the just world of God. No translation is going to encapsulate everything that Jesus imagined, but they all point to something that we can grasp. This world, our home, this society in which we live is dear to us, but is suffering mightily. And it needs the healing that it sometimes so stubbornly resists. But why then did Matthew choose to go a slightly different way, using the kingdom of the heavens? Well, we know that the phrase the heavens can stand in for God. So, in dialogue with the scribes, Jesus asks them whether John's baptism has come from heaven or from men. And in the parable of the prodigal son, the young guy says to his father that he has sinned before heaven. Clearly, heaven means God. But when Matthew repeatedly uses the phrase kingdom of the heaven, I think he's pointing at something special. This phrase sets up a strong bifurcation or division between heaven and earth. Your kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. Matthew is drawing attention to the ideological battle for our political space. There are two very opposed ways of looking at the world, the earthly and the heavenly. Matthew is clearly signaling that Jesus is in a socio-political conflict and that he wants alternative values to descend to us, so to speak.
Yeah, I sort of hinted at that in the discussion of the Sermon on the Mount.
There's a second issue, though, here. One of the great things about your theological stance, Bert, and I know it's not something you invented, and others have contributed to this as well, is that the focus on transformative social justice finally makes concrete sense out of the apocalyptic utterances of Jesus. When will the kingdom of God arrive? When will the kingdom of the heavens arrive? For many centuries, people have been, have found these warnings, for example, in Matthew 24 to 25, which you still have to deal with in your podcast, as grim and foreboding and threatening. This gospel of the kingdom will be preached throughout the world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come, in Matthew 24. What sort of an end should we have in view? When will all this end? What kind of new kingdom is going to come? And has it already started? Now, of course, there's lots of theological answers that we're familiar with. I think most of them ignore the possibility that there's a message of political engagement in the Jesus movement. So we have this idea that the kingdom is a moral stance of the individual. We have the view that the end is in mind here is that Jesus is going to come with a destructive army of angels to destroy the earth and transport us somewhere safe. And then we also have the existentialist perspective, that we are sort of in the end already, that the future has arrived, that we're now in the hour of decision for our lives. But if we really believe that Jesus wanted to improve people's lives in a very practical way, and that he trained them in strategies for transforming their communities, then the apocalyptic message suddenly makes a different kind of sense. It's a judgment on politics as usual. It's a judgment on oppression, on selfish and predatory politicians. Instead of separating people, Jesus envisions how spreading his message and his strategies, his techniques, brings people from all nations together in a world of mutual support and concern. When those things happen, Jesus says, the end has arrived. Now, as you know, the word telos, which is translated as end, means completion, fulfillment. If you throw a football and the receiver catches it in the end zone, that's a telos. The pass didn't end, it was completed. If it's intercepted, it also didn't achieve its telos. And Jesus says the scriptures will be fulfilled, not ended. And what is the telos, the completion of the scriptures? The final establishment of God's new society. So, on the basis of those considerations, I take this conventional reading, the one that says, this gospel of the kingdom will be preached throughout the world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. And I turn it a bit, reshape it with these thoughts in mind, and translate as follows. The liberating message of the alternative society will be communicated everywhere to be ratified by the nations, and then the goal will be achieved.
Yeah, that's a lot more relevant. That's something that makes sense for our world. Can you give another example? You said something about rejecting the word freedom. What's the problem with freedom?
Oh, yes, this is a good subject. Traditionally, the Greek word eleftheria is translated as freedom. How shall we do it? Well, let's first acknowledge that freedom is one of the most conspicuous and celebrated ideological concepts of modern Western society. Nowadays, people almost get misty-eyed when someone speaks of the individual freedom to speak or to believe or to worship as one sees fit. However, the scriptures never talk about freedom of the individual, freedom of speech, freedom of religion. And I think the biblical writers would be horrified to see their words being understood like that. They were far more collectivist in their consciousness. They wanted to live in their traditional communities. The individual's speech and behaviors have socially determined limits. In antiquity, to be free means to be a member of a free state. That is, you are free collectively. And that's not so crazy. Now, I know that most people from the U.S. hold their First Amendment to their Constitution as sacrosanct, especially the bit about freedom of speech. However, I'm not so sure if U.S. citizens who defend unrestricted individual free speech recognize just how untenable this position really is. In recent years, social media abuses show the dangers of granting complete freedom of speech. Free speech defenders see this as, just as one of the problems we just have to live with somehow. But that's not true. In most other countries and societies, universal free speech is not considered desirable. I think most people living today outside of the U.S. still see the need for limiting and also punishing hate speech and racist abuse for the good of society and the individual. Over here in Germany, you are not permitted to promulgate lies about the Jews, and except for a few extremists, most people over here see that as a very good thing. But getting back to Jesus, having the freedom to express your unique individuality was certainly not a theme for the Jews of antiquity. What they wanted was something completely different: freedom from oppression, meaning liberty. Those old stories about Moses freeing the people from Egyptian captivity, they were very much alive during the Roman occupation of the early Jesus movement. What they wanted was a similar political liberation. And I think that's how we should understand Eleftheria. So the Black Lives Matter movement, with its call for liberation from racist bondage, is much closer to what freedom means in the scriptures. As a practical example, let's look at one of the passages talking about freedom. Matthew 17. Here we have the temple tax collectors talking to the disciple Peter. They ask him, "Does your teacher, Jesus, pay the tax?" And in his usual manner, Peter responds spontaneously, saying, "Well, yes, he does." I think it's interesting that the conversation isn't with Jesus, but instead with this impetuous Peter. Did he really know that Jesus was willing to pay the temple tax? Or did Peter just assume it? The clue is that immediately after this short exchange, we have the unusual situation that Jesus takes Peter aside for a debriefing. And I can imagine Jesus putting his arm around him. He says to Peter, "You know, Peter, the kings of the earth," who are the exact opposite of the king of the heavens, "the kings of the earth don't tax their own children and retainers. They tax the others. And why? Because the sons are eleftheri, they are free people." Now, I don't know about you, but I've heard sermons that try to tell me we are free in the same way. God has freed us from sin because we are his sons and daughters. So we don't have to pay the tax of our sins, namely damnation. But that's a pretty sloppy exegesis. As soon as we look at the socio-historical background of this episode, that interpretation falls apart. Jesus is pointing out that there are full Roman citizens, and the Latin word for that is cives, who are exempt from taxes. They have the privilege of tax freedom. On the other hand, the great majority, who are at the lower rungs of society, including Jesus and Peter, whether they're freedmen or women or slaves, have to pay the tax. They have not been freed or liberated. They continue to bear the yoke of oppression, and Jesus sees that. There's another aspect to this. The ancient Romans and Greeks saw a fundamental division between freedom and slavery. At the time of Jesus, you know, we're talking about hundreds of thousands, if not millions of slaves, who were essential for the workplaces, for agriculture, for everything. Slaves were the drivers of the economy, making life comfortable for all free people. But a free man has rights. A slave does not. So to say, "I am free," means first and foremost, I am a citizen with special privileges. I am not a slave. So when Jesus talks about tax exemptions and says these people are free, he labels them as privileged elites. So if I was going to riff on this Bible passage now, I would translate it like this: the kings of the earth don't tax their own children and retainers because they have elite privilege. And when you come to think about it, in the modern West, in the USA, Canada, it's the same thing. Those who have real freedom are also the elites. And that's not a value that Jesus cares about.
Wow. Yeah. So that's coming up pretty soon in my podcast, that section. So now I think I'll just skip it because you've taken care of that one. So no, I'll definitely come back to this when I get to that passage. That's awesome. So how did you start working on these ideas about translations? Have other academics been working on these themes?
Philosophical hermeneutics played a pretty important part of my graduate studies. And more recently, here in Germany, I've been influenced by European scholars like Toon Verkamp and others writing in German. But as you know, there's a lot of sociopolitical analysis in English as well, from biblical scholars and from linguists, from historians looking back at the first century AD with a much more critical eye than in previous generations. The scholarship of this era used to be dominated by a lot of stubborn old ideas that are now thankfully being swept aside. Perhaps the most insidious old tradition in New Testament scholarship that needed to be just tossed out was the anti-Jewish and anti-Semitic perspective on Jesus and his followers. If you claim that Jesus or Paul started a new religion, you can basically treat the Hebrew Bible, Jesus' scriptures, as insignificant or inferior, secondary. And the consequence will be that you don't see just how deeply Jesus was involved in, committed to his people and their way of life. We tend to make the past in our own image and read the stories in the belief that our concepts and our priorities, our own biases and ideologies are written down in them. And so we don't see just how Jewish Jesus was. You won't see why it's important for Jesus to worship at the temple, or why he was committed to reforming the abuses at the temple. You won't see how the Jesus movement was Jewish at its very core. So that's one thing. But there's a second long-standing tradition among classically trained academics that held sway for the longest time, namely romanticizing classical Greco-Roman culture. Many academics believed that the Romans, or at least the more highly educated ones, were a sensitive, cultured, civilized, morally upright people who treated their slaves with dignity, and they only fought wars to bring the benighted, illiterate barbarians into the glorious light of reason. And I was taught something like that as well back in the day. Bert, you're familiar with the movie Monty Python's Life of Brian?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I've seen that movie. It takes place in Palestine at the time of Jesus. There's a guy named Brian who people think is the Messiah. And there's a political rivalry between two Jewish liberation groups, the People's Front of Judea and the Judean People's Front.
Exactly. Now, one character in the film is a freedom fighter from, I think it's the People's Front of Judea, who wants to motivate his comrades with a fiery speech to take up arms against the Romans. And he asks provocatively, "What have the Romans ever done for us?" And in answer, his friends, one after the other, list the various improvements that Roman rule has brought. So the leader concedes each one of these improvements, but he still wants to incite a rebellion. And so after this long list, he ends with the final question. "All right, but apart from the sanitation, the medicine, the education, wine, public order, irrigation, roads, a freshwater system and public health, what have the Romans ever done for us?" And at that point, then the final gag comes when someone hesitantly suggests, "They brought peace." And with that punchline, we get a thumping repudiation of those who might try to criticize Roman rule. "Look at all the stuff the Romans have done for us." And the movie really encourages us to laugh at anyone who doesn't appreciate just how much progress Roman rule has brought. But I would say the joke is really on Monty Python. That was really a wonderful piece for the Palestinians. The common people didn't get Roman wine. Palestinian wine was probably just as good anyway. The rural people were not included in Roman irrigation systems. They didn't get public order or education or medicine. What did they get? They got the threat, do as we say, honor our gods, worship the emperor, pay our crippling taxes, and shut up, or we will torture you to death. That's the Pax Romana, the Roman peace, from the perspective of the oppressed. So, it's no surprise that there were so many uprisings in the age of Jesus. And the Romans certainly had some serious headaches with their Palestinian provinces. Judea was perhaps its most insubordinate and refractory conquered nation during the first century. Two of the emperors, Gaius and Trajan, were so frustrated with Palestine that they both said they'd actually prefer to liquidate all the Jews because they were born to slavery. So there you have it, a supposedly high-minded, benevolent society stratified into different levels of humanity, providing lots of civilizing improvements for the higher classes who buy into the system, and offering crucifixion for those who agitate. Now, if you believe that the Romans were an enlightened people, as people, used to argue, you'll turn a blind eye to the huge injustices that formed the basis of Roman rule, and you won't see how the Jesus movement was responding directly to the terror and plunder and racism of that regime. And these newer fields of research, you know, this is nothing original in my case, you know, these have been established over the last 10 to 20 years. They have huge implications for how we need to retranslate the Bible. For many centuries, all of the best Bible scholars were trained in classical studies. We knew how wonderful the Romans were considered to be, so they were starkly influenced by this terrible stuff about the inferior Jews and the exalted Greco-Roman rulers. And I think we're only beginning to scratch the surface of how to deal with this in our translation work. I think it's still an unfinished task.
Yes, and what you're talking about sounds very familiar for our society, our Western societies today. So this is largely a modern day effort to restore ancient meanings.
There is something of a modern movement, that's true, but it's interesting to note that the struggle to translate adequately didn't begin in the modern era. It's of course always an enormous challenge. We can go back to the beginnings of the New Testament translation work. There's an interesting little story here. The very first translation from Greek into Latin did something unusual with the beginning of John's Gospel. We all know how it begins. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Right? Which lots of people find to be a clear indication of the divinity of Jesus. Sure, but what is happening here? We are translating the Greek logos with word. Why this translation? Logos can be translated in very different ways, and word is certainly not its primary meaning. Usually, logos means a reason or an explanation, a statement or a thought. It can be a continuous dialogue, like a story or a speech. But note, one thing that logos certainly does not mean is this, a single individual word or term taken on its own. And yet that is exactly the primary meaning of the term that we use in English. So either the New Testament is going out on a limb and using Greek in a very special way, or something else is going on here. And a helpful hint is to look at what the very first Latin translators did with this passage. When they read this logos and looked for the right Latin translation, they did not use verbum, which would be straightforwardly the word. Instead, they translated the Greek with the Latin term sermo, which usually and most generally means conversation or discourse. Now I ask you, what were these early Latins thinking when they translated the start of John's Gospel with In the beginning was the narrative, and the narrative was with God, and the narrative was God. Try to get your head around that. I don't exactly know what to make of that, but I find it fascinating. In any case, the issue of translating the New Testament in an anti-hierarchical way is not new.
Yeah. So now you said earlier that you have problems with using words, the words faith, love, or freedom as translations. Now you've already talked about freedom and its replacement by liberation, but what about faith, which is probably the most frequently used word in the Christian vocabulary? What is the problem there?
Sure. Let's take a key passage, Romans 3. Verse 21-22, which in the NRSV reads as follows. But now, apart from law, the righteousness of God has been disclosed and is attested by the law and the prophets, the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. Faith in Jesus. It's pretty useful, universally understood as believing in Jesus, confessing him, having him in our hearts, and so on. Now, what I would like to do is, first of all, begin with the semantic field of faith and belief. We should keep in mind the Hebrew concept that lies behind this, that lies at the root. And that's the word for covenant between Creator and a group of humans. In a contract or a federation or in a covenant, everything depends on reliability. Can I trust you? Can you trust me? Can we be reliable partners in the covenant? This is one of the major themes of the Hebrew Bible. It's what so-called faith is all about. Remaining true to Creator as Creator remains true to us. It's really about being faithful and reliable. Now, let's go to the New Testament. By contrast, the Greeks and the Romans had very different ways of looking at social contracts, and it's reflected in their words. Pistis is the Greek term, and the Latin is fides. Let's look at the Latin fides, first of all, from which we get words like fidelity or bona fide. Now, fides, for the Romans, was always a relation between non-equals. And this is how Roman imperialism defined its international relationships. There's a basic inequality between conqueror and conquered. On one hand, you have Roman military might. On the other hand, the conquered peoples with their local rulers, satraps, high priests, servants and slaves, and whatever. And all of them are debtors to the Romans. They are obliged to express their fides to the Romans. That is, they must remain faithful to them. And for that reason, they're allowed to live. The arrangement includes confessions of loyalty and acts of emperor worship as well. Now, that's fides. The Greek concept of pistis, which the New Testament uses, is actually quite different. Pistis is a bilateral relationship of reciprocity, or you could say of faithfulness, loyalty, trust. We can imagine it this way. With pistis, two people look each other in the eye. Whereas with the Latin term fides, one person looks down in humiliation to the ground. So pistis is much closer to the conception of covenant in Hebrew tradition. In Paul's thinking, pistis is bound up with faithfulness, trust, allegiance, loyalty. In fact, where we usually see the word faith, loyalty is probably the best way to translate it. This is how Gord Zerba, a New Testament scholar in Winnipeg, develops the concept in detail in his book on Paul's theology. Who are the faithful, Zerba asks? They are the loyalists. Now, you might think that the distinction between pistis as trust or loyalty and fides as faith or belief isn't so great, then there's a bit of a relationship between those words. But the difference can be shown more clearly if we simply look for a test. So let's run a test. Bert, how do I know if you have fides, that is, true faith or belief? Well, the quickest and shortest means is basically just asking you, do you believe X? And then you can state your belief, you can confess your faith. But now let's use the other term. How do we know if you have pistis? Are you loyal? Are you trustworthy? And straight away we know there is no quick and easy answer. No quick and easy test. More is needed. I would need to observe how you act over time. There's no shortcut. Loyalty shows itself by the manner in which one lives. That's pistis. If we think back to the matter of Constantinian theology, which positioned itself to police and control religion, which of these words do you think that the officially co-opted priests would prefer? Clearly, they want a quick test of whether you have faith, belief, or in Latin, fides. They want immediate social control. They demand a brief answer that reinforces the inequality between the interrogator and the interrogated. Okay, having said all of that now, let's go back to that passage in Romans 3 and the phrase, the righteousness or justice of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. The Greek text says literally, through the pistis of Jesus Christ. What are we to make of that? It sounds an awful lot like the loyalty of Jesus, doesn't it? Why is that not the dominant translation? And then it goes on to say, for all people having pistis, for all loyalists. So when I consider all these options and thoughts, I translate the verse as follows. But now, independently of the Torah itself, God's justice has been disclosed and is attested by the law and the prophets. God's justice through the faithfulness of our sovereign Jesus for all who are loyal. Is there a requirement here that we must have faith? No. Instead, Jesus has shown himself to be faithful, and we have an opportunity to respond by showing our faithfulness or loyalty to God. We have been given this option, so let's try it out. Let's take the risk of living in the new society.
Okay, so I think I get it. Now, what about the third word, love? How could you possibly have a problem with love? I mean, God loves us. God is love. Jesus teaches us to love one another. Surely you don't want Jesus followers to stop exercising love.
Right. Actually, the whole issue of love in the Bible needs a podcast. When you finish this one, maybe you can start one on love.
Sounds good. Yeah.
And after that, a whole new series then on the concept of truth as well. But right now, let's take a chance on love. I'll begin my answer by quoting an old Christian rocker from the 1970s named Larry Norman. Have you heard of him, Bert?
Oh, yes. I was a big Larry Norman fan in my younger days.
Yeah, me too. In one of his songs, he says, the Beatles sang All You Need Is Love, and then they broke up. Which sort of encapsulates the issue, right? What is love if it doesn't last forever? Again, we need to go back to the roots, remembering that Jesus and his disciples spoke Aramaic and heard many Hebrew readings. Concerning love, their primary reference point would have been the Shema in Deuteronomy chapter 6. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. You must love the Lord your God with all your mind, your whole being, and all your strength. Which it sounds really wonderful, but it does become a rather problematic passage if you continue reading, because it continues with the command to annihilate the indigenous peoples of the land. But let's not get into that today. My approach to the semantic field of love is once again politically oriented. I want to use as a central reference point a text of New Testament discourse on love, that famous passage in 1 Corinthians 13. So let's take the verse. If I speak with the tongues of mortals and angels but do not have love, then I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. Let's try to find an alternative political reading for that. When we situate this passage in the context of power relations, and that's what my translation work is attempting to do, then I observe that the letter to the Corinthians begins with critical remarks, right in chapter 1, begins with critical remarks on eloquence and wisdom. Chapter 1, verse 20. Paul writes, has not God made foolish the wisdom of the wise? And in chapter 2, verse 1, I did not come to you with lofty words or wisdom. Now, here's the key point. Training in philosophy and rhetoric were hallmarks of a good Hellenistic education, which only the elites could attain. Paul eschews these signs of good breeding and influence over others to champion the approach called love or agape. In the letter, he talks again and again about the dangers of boasting, for example. Now, if we read 1 Corinthians 13 in terms of power relations, we see the same kind of descent or stooping that Paul also uses to describe Jesus in Philippians, where it says, he emptied himself and took on the form of a servant. And this is not simply self-abasement, but rather allying oneself with the downtrodden, with the people down at the bottom. The original story of Israel is that God allies himself or herself with a disadvantaged, enslaved minority, with the people way at the bottom. As it says in Deuteronomy 7, it is not because you were more numerous than all the other peoples that the Lord favored and chose you, for in fact you were the least numerous of all people, meaning the most insignificant. So this word love, in many instances, maybe not all, but many, concerns a relationship of solidarity that is not reciprocal or mutual, it's one-sided, and it's concerned with people who are needy, poor, and destitute. Walter Brueggemann suggests as a translation for love, tenacious solidarity. So if we take this background and attempt to translate that verse in 1 Corinthians again, this is what I come up with. If I speak with the tongues of mortals and angels, including if I can translate the New Testament, but do not stand in tenacious loyalty with those who do not possess my privileges, then I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal, perhaps also including in a podcast. That translation might not work so well at a wedding, I don't think, but it does point us beyond these discussions about words towards the need to act in resolute solidarity with those who are excluded from our social order.
Well, this is all excellent to consider the words and phrases that are being translated, and this speaks to a lot of things that I'm doing in the podcast, and I hope that people listening to this are getting some clarity on areas where I have not been so clear, that you have given more depth and clarity and explanation. So I think this really helps in the work that I'm trying to do in the podcast. Now, our listeners are also interested in the practical implications of what we're talking about. Can you tell us something about the peace work you're involved in?
Yeah, sure. Maybe two things. I think some of your listeners may have heard about the refugees on the Greek island of Lesbos. Last September, there was a, an event of great significance, which was also in the international news, about a camp called Moria that burnt down, leaving thousands of people stranded on the streets. We could see them. By accident, I was there at the time, and so we were able to help some of the people who had been kept in a prison there. But you'll probably have noticed since September there haven't been a lot of great news stories, because the only thing that's changed is that the migrants have been isolated even further. And many new arrivals are being intercepted at sea and being pushed back secretly, illegally, across the international border back to Turkey, where they came from, which is extremely dangerous and, of course, against international law. Our work is in solidarity with those migrants, listening to and broadcasting their stories, as well as investigating and documenting the human rights abuses that have been perpetrated by the Greek government and by the European Union as well. This project is our program is run by Christian peacemaker teams, and it has the name Aegean Migrant Solidarity. So if people want to look it up on Facebook, Aegean Migrant Solidarity. And we also published a damning report about the way that people were treated, called Incarcerating the Marginalized. So if people wanted to get in contact with us, they could also get that report in English.
And where would they get that report?
Just send an email to our organization, info@dmfk.de. info@dmfk.de.
Yeah, right. Well, that's amazing work. And the work of Christian Peacemaker Teams, also cpt.org, or just Google Christian Peacemaker Teams and they could find that there. Yeah, exactly. That's really important work. I have a little bit of history with Christian Peacemaker Teams myself. Really a great organization. One thing I didn't mention, I think you might have mentioned it, but we're you're from a Mennonite background. I mean, you mentioned that in your introduction, and you're working for a Mennonite organization now. I happen to be part of a Mennonite church here in Southern California. It's the only Mennonite church I've ever been a part of. So I'm not, I don't have a background. I grew up evangelical, but So thanks for all of this, James. This has been so great. I mean, this is really deepens a lot of the things that I'm trying to do in the podcast, and it's good to get somebody that has explored these things from another angle and can explain them in a way and push these ideas and this kind of, cause I'm doing an interpretation, a translation of the gospel on the podcast. And you're looking at the actual words and how to translate them. So this has been incredibly helpful. I'm really appreciative that you've, come on the podcast and been willing to do this.
It's my pleasure. It's been a really good talking to you. And I benefit a great deal as well from your podcast. I'm very curious to hear what's going to be coming up next.
Yeah, me too. I'm always curious to hear what's going to be coming up next. All right. So we will leave it there. And thank you, everyone, for listening. It is now May 4th, and I think we'll probably get this out in the next few days. And after that, we will proceed with the rest of chapter 16 in Matthew. Thank you so much. This has been a special episode of Bible Study, Parody and Subversion in Matthew's Gospel. Thank you.